We're in some very impressive country right here, and so many firsts happened on this part of the planet. If we listen to classical writers, Roman and Greek historians, they talk about the Iron Age beginning in this place, so a great leap forward in material science. It's reputedly the place of the first vineyard, and you look at the soil, that makes perfect sense. But the person who planted that vineyard, well, that was Noah after the great deluge. If you were reading Norse mythology in the 1200s, Snorri Sturluson would point you here. He was a great chieftain who told the stories of the Norse gods, the Æsir, and he said that Odin and his advanced people came from these mountains and moved into Northern Europe and took those lands for themselves. Somehow, technologically, they were so advanced of the Northern Europeans, they could just pick which bits of Northern Europe they wanted. There are so many firsts here that I've listed in other places, but to be standing here and considering the possibility that people could have secreted themselves in this mountain range is not hard to believe, and the land is very, very fertile. If you were going to reboot humanity, as the stories of Haik and Noah go, this is a pretty good place to do it.
Join me as I travel through the beautiful province of Van in the company of friend and fellow researcher, Matt McCroy. The Van province, in the traditional lands of Anatolia, in the modern country of Turkey. Anatolia, its name means the land where the sun rises again, at the curve of the fertile crescent, a land of milk and honey. Anatolia is home to many firsts in the story of humanity. According to classical authors of ancient Greece and Rome, Anatolia was the place where the Iron Age began. Here, for the first time, humans began to build with baked bricks. At Karajadağ, the first known farm of cultivatable crops and animal husbandry made its appearance some 10,000 years ago. It's home to one of the world's oldest languages. The biblical story of Noah locates the reboot of human civilization here after the Great Deluge. The Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh records the survivor of the flood being taken to live in a garden beyond the mountains. And Ezekiel 28 in the Bible places Eden, the place of human origins, on the holy mountain of God. And in my new book, The Invasion of Eden, I argue that the story of Abraham from the Bible is really a story of human origins, and it too has its roots in the lands of ancient Armenia, in and around the Van province of Anatolia.
Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description. Sign up and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 3 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content. My expertise is in the area of narrative traditions, and I'm interested in how many narrative traditions point to this exact part of the world as the place of beginnings or new beginnings for humanity. So Karajadar was really a place of new beginnings, where we see the evidence for the first farm in our known civilization 10,000 years ago. It was discovered in 1998 by Manfred Hoyn and a team from the University of Az in Norway and the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, Germany. And yet, just down the road, within the same country, is Göbekli Tepe, a megalithic society which pre-existed the first farm. And so here we have a story, maybe of the baton being passed from a previous civilization to a new one. The story of Abraham, I argue in The Invasion of Eden, belongs to ancient Armenia and to this region of the world. The place names clue us that that may be the case, and the names of the people groups and their gods suggest the same thing. This is the country of Haldi. And Abraham came from the Ur, the high place of Haldi. And this is exactly where we were in the region of Van on our recent tour. So I want to walk you through that journey, walk you through this amazing land of milk and honey, and talk about some of the archaeological places which are really key to our understanding of the human story. I was already excited about going here, knowing from Matt LaCroix about Ayanas Kalesi, Kef Kalesi, and Chavos Tepe, and the significance of those finds. But my friend David Lovegrove, who has a channel, Viking Superpowers, had also directed my attention here, because in the 1200s, the post-Viking chieftain Snorri Sturluson wrote down what he knew of the sagas of the ancient gods, the Æsir of the Norse tradition. And he argued that Odin and his people, and he believed Odin was a real person. He didn't believe all the Norse myths were history, but Odin, he believed, had history in it. And he argued that Odin came to Northern Europe and Scandinavia with his people from the lands which he called Asaland, which we would now remember as ancient Armenia, in the lands of Anatolia, in the modern country of Turkey. And so as I traveled to this mountainous region, I had this real excitement that I might be going to the place of Asgard, where these advanced people came from, according to the ancient master Snorri Sturluson. Well, our journey began at the Van Museum, and I must take my hat off to what they've recently created as the new museum at Van. They have gathered together finds from archaeological sites and created some facsimiles of larger objects that can't be moved. So I'm just going to talk you through some of the objects that really caught our attention. Now, by the time we got to Van Museum, we were already making friends in the province. We found the Kurdish and Turkish people who live in the Van province to be so warm and welcoming. And I would say the same for the people I spoke to at the Van Museum as well. The first mystery thrown up by the artifacts at the Van Museum is the question of how many building cultures are we looking at? So we found three building conventions: a building with basalt, which requires really advanced megalithic skills. It's not an easy stone to work with. And then there was work with the local stone, the limestone. And then there was the work done with mud brick. All those materials have been used in the region. And the difference between the technologies is quite striking when you see them side by side in the museum context, all the more so when you get onto site.
from the survivors right here. Still finely cut stones, but not basalt. Makes you wonder if the reason they didn't use basalt, not only because they couldn't manipulate it, but because they didn't have access to basalt. They would have had to go all the way to Mount Suphan to get more basalt to rebuild it, and they couldn't. And so they used the local stone here to try to rebuild this temple. And they try to put it back together.
What you can see around us is actually several different building styles, right, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, right behind you is a really classic, for instance, here's the mud brick building. On top of this, which is the precise basalt, beautifully cut, we'll show some interesting joins.
Exactly.
Walk around. And if we look across here, of course, that is what happens to mud bricks.
Yes. They don't last very long, do they?
But you know what? In the Bible, Bible readers will remember in Genesis 11, the invention of mud bricks and building with bricks is remembered as a great leap forward in civil engineering. So there's the great leap forward built on top of this. So we have to do some maths. The question is this a single culture, the Urartu culture? And the places we went to were known as places that had been developed in the 8th and 7th centuries BCE. Was it that they built with all these materials and that everything we were looking at was built in one hit? Or is it possible that the Urartu people built on the foundations of structures from the people who lived there previously? Now, the conventional wisdom is that the Urartians of the 8th and 7th century BCE built with basalt blocks at the base of their buildings, and then the higher parts of their walls were built with mud bricks with vaulted roofs over the top. And that may very well be the case, but it might not be. It is possible that there were cultures living there previously who had built on the same high places. This really is at a key node in the Fertile Crescent, and it seems improbable that the Urartu people were the very first people to live in this region, especially with all these ancient narratives pointing to this region as a place of firsts, the place where the Iron Age happened for the first time. We hear that from the classical writers of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, the place where the first vineyard was planted, according to the story of Noah in the Bible. And it's a great place for vineyards when you look at the kind of soil they have. Is it really likely, given these narrative attestations and the fertility of the area, that the 8th century BCE was the first period in history when people lived here and the first time that people had built structures here? It seems likely that there would have been something on these high places prior to the Urartu people. Is it possible they built on the foundations left behind from prior people groups? So this caught our attention and raised the question, basalt building, how many courses of basalt blocks did the Urartians build with? Did they know how to engineer basalt to the full extent that we were seeing on the sites? Is it correct that they built three or four courses and then built with mud brick? Or is there another story to be told? Another very interesting artifact that we found was a doorway, the Gateway of Haldi. Now, this is a facsimile of a place we visited a couple of days later. It reminded me very much of other carved doorways that we find around the world, such as in Peru. It reminded me of the naos that was found at Tel El Farah in the Levant. Doorways with nothing around them, no building, nothing behind them, but an expectation that the advanced being who is honored by the local culture will return through that doorway. Where does that idea come from? I mean, we have a word for that today. We would call it a portal. So where does the idea come from that advanced beings will return through a doorway, not in a ship, not in an advanced craft, not from the sky, but through a doorway. Halfway up a cliff, on a back street, in a quiet suburb of Van, is the original gateway of the Urartu god Haldi. Here he would return, surrounded by light. But why here, and not at one of the holy sites,
Why halfway up a cliff? What did the locals see or experience in this place that made them feel this was the place Haldi would return to and believe it so strongly that they would go to the great effort of constructing this amazing doorway out of the limestone? From the ancient Celtic stories of the Sith, who could transport themselves on a beam of light, to the Urartu people, who told of their god Haldi appearing from out of nowhere on a beam of light, the idea of powerful beings portaling from the great beyond into the here and now is repeated by cultures around the world. Also in the museum were these extraordinary triple arches, the central arch being taller than the arch to each side. Now, the triptych doorway or the triptych window is a convention in sacred archaeology that seems to transcend religions and transcend the ages. There's no inscription on these arches. So simply the shape of them is supposed to convey a message. But what was that message? We have the triptych arches there, and then we have the three-stepped triptych doors on the box, the basalt box of Haldi. Now, this was one of four corners of a structure within a temple, and it repeats that message. There was another kind of triptych doorway or triptych window that we found in the museum, one example of it. And here, the doorway is in 3D, where it's sort of inset and inset again. What's the meaning of this object? And was this the only one found? Well, we were to get an answer to that question when we visited the site at Çevre Tepe.
This looks like one of the original basalt columns right here, sticking out of the ground. See this? Yeah, this is one of the original basalt columns. It's just sitting here. It's not even... There it is. Oh my God. Holy cow. You can't see this anywhere in the world. One of the most sacred artifacts, one of the most oldest sacred artifacts on earth, lying here, sitting here in ruin, covered in grass. This is what we're talking about a true expedition. This is not a public tourism site. We're uncovering real history here. Take a look at this. Massive, massive basalt column. Now notice, I saw the other one over there, and that's what tipped me off to this, because that's another piece that's there. Now there's another one right above it here. Amazing. Now, what I find fascinating is that these are completely ignored. They're away from the site. Basically, nobody cares about these. And what's fascinating is that these are the oldest remnants of the Ararat civilization right here. These are the original artifacts they carved at a beautiful basalt. This is over 1 ton, this artifact. Over 1 ton. Someday these will be in museums. And one day, society will understand the importance of these artifacts and how they link everything from Göbekli Tepe to Menorca, Spain, with these T-shaped pillars. I call them the Pillar of Ascension. Let's go check out these other two on the ground. Oh, amazing, amazing. These two have been uncovered. They're not partially buried. This now makes seven. Seven of these ascension pillars we've found along this area. Just incredible. Look at the size of these. Solid basalt, these have to be 1 to 2 tons each. Absolutely massive, which thankfully is one of the reasons why they haven't been taken yet.
So Saba, you live in an amazing part of the world. So many firsts happen on this part of the planet. And something I learned quite recently, the Viking sagas of the Viking gods point to this part of the world. So in the 1200s, they had a chieftain, Snorri Sturluson, and he wrote the ancient stories of Odin and Thor and the other gods. And he said that Odin came from here, from these mountains.
No kidding.
That he and his people were based in a secret location in these mountains, and that they were so advanced compared with the people living in Northern Europe that they just decided they would move into Northern Europe and take those countries just like that. And when Snorri Sturluson wrote that, he said, we know there's a connection between Scandinavia and these lands here because of the language. He said the language we all speak in Scandinavia now is based on what was spoken in Ararat. And he said there's the proof that Odin came from there, from the territory we're in now.
That's interesting, isn't it? The connection of different mythologies, right?
But and such, you say mythology. Mm. He thought that was real world history because he's pointing to evidence in language in the real world to say, do you see, we are connected.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you see, mythology, the truth is that, is it really mythology or is it actually real?
Exactly.
Magic.
We have so many mythology, so many legend stories around here.
Well, walking up to Chavez Tepe was an amazing experience. It reminded me of my experience of visiting the Palatino in Rome. Now, that's the palace where the Roman emperors used to live, right on the top of the hill. And it was a huge complex of beautiful buildings. And from there, they had this phenomenal view across the whole city, the enormous city of ancient Rome. And living there, well, the emperor would have felt like the king of the world, such an amazing vantage that he had. Well, Chavez Tepe is like that. When you walk up to that site, you reach the top and you've got this panoramic view of the province backed by these awesome mountains. You're looking across all the farming country that is making your part of the planet so rich and so precious. And again, you would have felt like the king of the world. Now, Chavez Tepe is known as Hike's Fortress, Hikebird. And within the fortress is Haldi's temple. And as we walked around, it just made me think how those words can predispose us to looking at a site in a certain way. So if I say this is a fort, we immediately think, okay, this is a military installation with a military purpose. That's how I'm going to see it. That's what I'm going to look for. But a fort really is just a fortified place. And we have fortified places today that are not military installations. We'd call them gated communities. And some fortresses were exactly that. They were communities with a wall around them. Think of Saint-Malo in France as an example. You could have a fortified residence for the king, for instance, or something that is purely a placeholder and is literally just a garrison or a fort. So to call something a fort, we need to dig a bit deeper and just look and say, well, what did happen here? What was this site used for? And within Hikebird, there is the Temple of Haldi. Now, again, the word temple is a loaded word, because if I say a place is a temple, we immediately think, ah, this is a religious installation. It exists purely for religious purposes. But in fact, temples served different purposes around the world. So you go to India and you'll find some temples to which people went for healing or because they wanted to have a baby. And there would be rituals and maybe even technologies used in those places to support health and fertility. So people weren't going to worship. They were going to get well and to get healthy. Some temples are like that. There are temples that are named in the Hebrew scriptures that we might think of as museums. They are places people go to commemorate certain aspects of the human story and of the Hebrew story. And so the temples and high places of Asherah would be an example. So again, Haldi's temple, Hike's Fort, but what did happen there? So we walked the site to get a feel of what this place really was. I was walking through the site with Dwight, our cameraman, and we came to a spot where all of a sudden I stopped and I said to Dwight, did you feel that? We just entered something. It was as if we had walked into a room, even though there was no doorway. You just felt this change of energy. It's hard to describe. It's almost like walking into a different temperature, but it wasn't a temperature thing. It was, I'm walking across a threshold into a different kind of space. And then I had to look around to work out, well, why am I feeling this? And I looked down at my feet and I could see a change of texture in the floor. And then when I looked to my right, I could see we were standing in the beginning of what had been a chamber. And as I looked around, I could see the perimeter of that chamber, and it was clearly some kind of a temple. We were standing in the narthex. We then moved into the nave. And Dwight, too, was saying that he felt very different in that space as we walked into the nave. When I looked to the far right, there was an object which, if it was a church, would be a font. And as I looked around the space, I realized it described exactly that shape. It had the atmosphere of walking into a church, even though there's so little of the structure left. The shape of it was so recognizable. Where there was the font, there was a round sacrificial altar. So that's where the lambs would be sacrificed and the blood let. And then the nave moves forward to the screen, what in an Orthodox church would be the iconostasis. And then there was a step up into the sanctuary. It was recognizable to me after 33 years in church-based ministry as that kind of space. The shape of it has been emulated by cultures all around the world. And the energy of the place remained. This was what really struck me, that even with only sort of three courses of big stones of the original construction, the place still had some kind of an integrity to it. It still had an effect on me and on Dwight as we moved around that space. And it was only having initially felt it and then looked around that we realized, well, yes, this part is a temple. This part did have some special function. And the fact that in its current iteration, we're walking around a space that's 2,800 years old, and we're still feeling the shape of it is extraordinary. But then what was there before? Very often, sacred spaces are built on top of even older sacred spaces. And this is certainly a high place in the high country. And that alone makes me wonder, how deep does this history go? How deeply rooted is the atmosphere of this place?
We're across the threshold here. Wow.
Here we are crossing the threshold and getting a sense of the shape of the building. To our right is the circular sacrificial altar.
You know you've just walked into somewhere, don't you?
Where a lamb would be slayed and the blood would be let, and there's a little channel to take the blood from that altar. And that's a ceremony that's done before the priests enter the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, and it's in there that you would find the high altar and all the symbology to accompany that. That exists there in the temple of Haldi Çavuştepe at Ayanas Kilesi. There is a high altar still in place, but we'll come to that in a moment. The things that gripped me were this chapel and the feeling as you walked into it. You knew you had walked into somewhere special. I felt the atmosphere change before I looked down and could see the flooring change, before I looked around and could see the perimeter of the building. And there at the entrance to the sanctuary is this stone with cuneiform script. It dedicates the place to the king who is known for having developed that site, King Sarduri II, in the 8th century BCE. The Urartu culture, with its use of cuneiform, would appear to be a late offshoot of the cultures that were really birthed by ancient Sumer. That's Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, Assyria. The Urartians had their own language, but it was expressed in cuneiform script. And at Çavuştepe, we were very excited to meet a man known as the last Urartian, Mehmet Kuzman. He showed us around the site. He translated the inscription in the Temple of Haldi. This is in a site known as Haykaberg, which is the fortress of Hayk. And Hayk is regarded as the progenitor of the Urartian people. Mehmet creates wonderful cuneiform scripts in basalt, and I have one with a very special message carved in it for me. And indeed, he gave me his book, which is a book about Mehmet's work. And I was so excited to have this. There's my name expressed in cuneiform script by Mehmet, who has become an expert in reading and understanding and writing Urartian in cuneiform. And here you can see Mehmet translating it for us.
His name is Mehmet Kushman. He is going to read what is written here. He's going to read in Urartian language.
Herkes hazır.
That's what he's going to tell us.
Dingir, Tanrı demek.
Dingir means in Urartian language God.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
İrmoşini, Eyniye, Susinia, Sardurişe, Argıştini. Argışta oğlu Sardur, bu tapınağı Tanrı İrmoşini için yaptı, inşa etti. Argışta oğlu Sardur.
King Sarduri II dedicates it, in effect, in his own honor, but also in the name of the great god Haldi, whom he acknowledges as the one who brought the secrets of agronomy to humanity in that place and allowed the people of that region to become farmers, city builders, civilization builders. But I noted it was carved very neatly into the basalt. And so it raised a question for me of, did the Urartians in fact have great expertise in working with basalt? Here they've carved cuneiform into it. Perhaps they did indeed work with both stones, and that the question of building cultures was more complex than I had at first thought.
And then he wrote my name in Urartian in cuneiform.
Cuneiform, wow. That's cool.
Also at the museum was a facsimile of the altar room within the temple of Haldi at Ioannis Kolessi. Now, we all had profound experiences when we went to the real place, but even looking at the facsimile was awe-inspiring. Covered with symbology that scholars would recognize as being the symbological language of ancient Sumer. So the style of drawing, the figures shown, the motifs, very recognizable. And among them, a series of crosses. A four-armed cross, a six-armed cross, and an eight-armed cross. And the meaning of those I find very intriguing. After our visit, I sat down with my friends Martin and James and talked through some of the associations of those crosses.
So we're here in the beautiful Lake Van region. This is my friend James. This is my friend Martin. The thing I immediately gravitated to was the crosses that appear there. Because these are crosses that long predate Christianity. And I'm very familiar with a whole range of shapes of cross that Christianity has used for 2,000 years. But these crosses belong to a period of history way before, probably every religious tradition we could name on the planet today. And we saw a number of different types of cross. I think four really struck me. We saw the four-armed cross. We saw a six-armed cross and an eight-armed cross. And when I looked at those, it just put me in mind of the language, the lexicon of the ancient Sumerians. Because we were surrounded by cuneiform.
More than I actually expected to see. I mean, it was like everywhere, all over the place.
It's very humbling because this is another civilization. We are the outsiders. We are the learners.
That's right.
We are having to do work to get a glimpse of who they were, what were they saying. But when it comes to the crosses, I do know this about Sumerian symbology. But if, say, I'm sitting in front of you, Martin, and I do a cross like this, I've just told you, you need to pay me some tax.
That's interesting.
I'm the taxer. That's the symbol for tax.
So the movement was what again exactly?
It's a vertical straight cross.
Okay.
Like that.
Yeah.
Tax. Give me some tax. Mm-hmm. If I do a different cross, if I do it on a slant, like
That.
Oh, okay, I get it. Yeah.
That's saying something similar but different. It's saying, I'm preeminent. Okay? I'm in charge of you now. That's if I put those two crosses together to turn it into an eight-armed cross, I'm preeminent. You pay me tax. I don't care who else you pay your tax to. I am the preeminent taxer. That's so what man. That symbol means.
Amen.
Now, interestingly, within Christianity, the cross carries a similar meaning. Now, the cross, as I was saying before, was not the original symbol for Christianity. It was the Emperor Constantine who brought that in. It was a symbol that he was already venerating. It represented the sun, and he was continuing his earlier religious practice. And so that symbol of the cross and the cross in a circle now gets placed behind the heads of Jesus and the saints. So when you're venerating them, you're still venerating the sun. So that's why he brought it in. And then it became the central symbol of Christianity, so that now when a Christian looks at the cross, actually it carries some of those Sumerian meanings still. We think of the preeminent one when we see the cross. We think of the chief taxer. I pay my tithes to the person represented by that cross.
Yes,
so
yes.
Somehow those old meanings have survived. But there's another layer of meaning too. Because this preeminent taxer, that's the symbol, the eight-armed cross, for a sky person, for a sky being. And of course, the Sumerian texts were full of sky beings, people like Enlil and Enki, who suddenly descend from the heights, and now they're governing Project Humanity, Project Earth. They're the preeminent taxes. They're the ones in charge. And so think of all the layers of meaning that have been carried by that symbology. And by the time those symbols were used at Ioannis, people knew what they meant. So when we say that might be the first cross, it's not the primitive cross. We can find a primitive cross 40,000 years ago in the caves of Lascaux. It's actually a whole lexicon, a whole language that's developed, so that the four-armed cross means this, the six-armed cross means this, the eight-armed cross means that. It's a whole language that we're having to learn. And as we go back to the original meanings, I find often I'm recognizing those meanings as I go back because they've survived.
From Chavos Tepe, we went to Ioannis Kolesi. Ioannis Kolesi is a beautiful site. The whole site has the most magical atmosphere to it. And as we walked through it, we found some clues as to why that might be the case. Here again, we saw the basalt courses at the bottom of the walls, and then mud brick built on top. Now, the mud brick seems like a very unsophisticated material to be using if you've gone to the great trouble of building with basalt blocks that you've transported 300 miles and then up a hill and then engineered into place. And as you can see from the hillside on the left, mud bricks don't age well. Now, in the Bible, the invention of brick was seen as a great leap forward. But in Genesis 11, the people who developed that in the Shinar Plain, according to the story, baked their bricks in kilns, so they were baked hard. These were sun-dried, and so didn't have the same resilience. So again, seeing it on site did raise the question of how many building cultures are we looking at? Is this a single culture but separated by hundreds of years? Or are we seeing the building media of two different cultures built in the same site? The basalt blocks have been built on an andesite bedrock in that hillside. So already you've got very distinct magnetic properties to those stones. As we walk through the public court of the temple at the top of the hill, we discovered this.
So here we are at, of course, the front entrance to the inner sanctum of Ioannis. And Paul and I were looking at the most incredible feature, Paul. It actually blew my mind seeing this. Yes. It is in massive hole that is so deep in front of this that you can't even see the bottom. Now, Paul, do we see any comparisons to that with, say, the Great Pyramid of Giza, perhaps?
Oh, we certainly do, because what we can see is that this is some kind of an aquifer. And the conventional answer as to why is that it's stormwater passage, except that if you want a site to affect how people feel, you need two things. Very hard stone.
Yes. Bedrock quartzite, yeah, like this, exactly. Yes.
And flowing water.
Right.
So they're not going to put a sewer right through the middle of their holy site.
No.
That's clean water flowing here for another purpose. And I believe it is to make this a sacred site.
Yes.
So that it has an impact on the people standing in this space. Yes. And in that space.
And we have to think about not just water, but sacred spring water, which is one of the reasons why this site was chosen, because the top of this mountaintop has an aquifer spring system that they must have engineered to flow right into or underneath the inner sanctum of Ionis. Come see this hole and see how deep it is. It's absolutely incredible.
And as you say, it parallels what happens at Giza.
Exactly. Can't even see the bottom of it. Who knows how far down it is, Paul? Absolutely amazing, showing that the ingenuity and high technology of the lost era civilization, it seemed nothing was beyond their ability to create.
That's right. And again, part of a global canon of knowledge.
Exactly. That knowledge of some kind of a quartzite bedrock that's high energy with an aquifer system seems to unlock powerful things with the human conscious potential, doesn't it, Paul?
It really does.
Ancient builders went to great trouble to create flowing water under the megalithic sites. This is true of the Giza Plain in Egypt underneath the Great Pyramid. Why did they do this? Because the combination of flowing water, dense magnetic rocks, has an impact on human bodies. When you walk into those places, there is a calming and elevating feeling that it creates. And the ancient builders knew this and wanted this to be a place of atmosphere that would still people and elevate them. And even today, when you walk onto that site, you can feel the physical effects of walking through that environment. Now, as a show of respect, when we got to the sanctuary, we removed our shoes. We weren't required to, but we wanted to show respect to the culture that had created this place, the culture whose secrets have now been lost, but hopefully are now being recovered. All the things precious to them forgotten, all their gods forgotten, but we want to be part of a retelling of their wonderful stories. We went in, and all of us had amazing experiences as we looked around at the original high altar, beautiful alabaster high altar, carved with designs full of meaning. There were carvings in the walls with little holes around them showing where the alabaster inlays originally were situated. Here is where I saw the four-armed cross, the six-armed cross, the eight-armed cross, with all those layers of meanings. This is to do with the star people. This is to do with the gods. This is to do with their preeminence. These are the messages and signals being repeated all around the walls for the priests as they stood in the Holy of Holies. For me, it's very interesting that all those layers of meaning associated with the cross have survived into the common era. Many of those associations still belong to the cross within Christianity. And yet those meanings go back so much earlier than Christianity, to the 8th and 7th century BCE, and very possibly even further back. And the site that really raised the question of timelines was Kefkelesi. Now this, oh my goodness, you feel like you are on top of the world, looking from a great height across the land, across the farms, down to the town of Adigevaz. And Adigevaz would have serviced Kefkelesi. People went there on pilgrimage. They would need places of accommodation. They would need food. And so Adigevaz has been a tourist attraction 3,000 years. We reached Kefkelesi after a two-hour drive from the city of Van, three police stops for passport checks, and a one-hour hike up a mountainside. And as we neared the top,
we began encountering basalt artifacts. And when I say artifacts, I mean multiple ton blocks, which had been hurled down the hillside from the castle and temple installation at the top. The feeling really was that some terrible catastrophe had happened here. But what would be a sufficient catastrophe to obliterate the grand buildings that originally adorned the top of this hill? Now, this whole region lies across a fault line, so it is known as being a place of volcanism and earthquakes. Would that be sufficient to have done the damage here? The blocks were scattered. There were no more than three courses on top of one another. But interestingly, here, as at Ayanas, we found burn damage on basalt, and pieces of basalt that had been absolutely vitrified. There was burn damage on the alabaster at Ayanas Kolesi as well. Was this really just a fire that had been started by an earthquake or by attacks from the ancient Scythians or Midianites in the 7th century BCE? Or had something even more dramatic happened here?
We're standing at Kef Kolesi, which is a really sobering sight. I've walked up the mountain here just carrying this, and that was hard work. Imagine the effort of bringing all this here and far more to build with basalt on the top of this hill. Now, down below, we have Adigevaz. It's an obvious place to build a town. It's a beautiful place right by the lake. But it's also a logical place to have a town to service Kef Kolesi, people who came here to work, people who came here on pilgrimage. And as I walked up today, it was somewhat sobering to be walking up sort of pristine rocky hills, and then here and there, these scattered basalt blocks that have been engineered and then tossed down the hill and broken. And bit by bit, they get bigger and bigger. You can see more and more engineering on the stone. And then we arrive at the site itself. This is a very impressive site. From the ground up, it's been built in basalt. So this is one civil engineering culture, that's for sure. And something that struck me as I arrived, I mean, this is what's left, but this would have been an enormous structure. What had to happen to reduce it to this? And if we look at the hillside down which much of this tumbled, down to the bottom of the hill where Haldi's basalt box was found, what caused that? We're on a fault line. So there are earthquakes here. There are dramatic geological events that hit this region. Is that the explanation? And it's certainly the conventional one. Or was it a far more significant cataclysm even than that? So the fact that it's built in basalt raises the question again, all right, it's the basalt building culture. So what timeline does that suggest? When did that begin? Now in the region, there have been structures made of basalt from ancient times all through the Common Era. You will find early churches built with basalt. So I actually think it's quite difficult to date just from the building culture what we're looking at here. And what I'd like to investigate is the events that destroyed it. I actually think it might be easier to date the site when we find events on a scale that could reduce a huge Kef Kolesi complex to this, and then everything that was adjacent. When you look from the sky, and you can do this via Google Earth, you look down and the rest of this complex has literally been wiped off the land. And so I'm interested in the timeline. And what I'm going to do is just get to know when were the geological events that could have caused this kind of destruction, and get an idea of which one of those might be responsible for what we're seeing today.
To begin to answer these questions, what we really need to do is go back with geologists, archaeologists, soil magnetization technology, ground penetrating radar, and find out how much of this structure is now under the hill. Then we will have a clearer picture of how many courses of basalt were built with here. Was it just three or four courses, or was there originally a grand structure built entirely of basalt on this place. And if that was the case, then where are all the other blocks? Are they under the hill, or have they been washed away by some phenomenal cataclysmic event? If it's the latter, it pushes the timeline for this site far further back into the mists of history and raises questions about the whole human timeline. If they are under the hill, then a geologist will help us understand how much time has elapsed since these blocks were hurled down the hill from their original setting. So we came away from Kefkalesi full of awe and full of questions. Looking from a great height across the land, across the farms, it really is a land of milk and honey. And it's not difficult to see why so many empires have passed through this place. One of our guides said, every empire has been through this place, and they've all left something behind. But sometimes what is left behind are the artifacts of a missing people group. We were looking at the buildings that belonged to the Urartu culture, which thrived in the 8th and 7th centuries BCE, but had been overtaken by the Scythians and the Midianites, who had attacked this region, and then the Medes or Midianites settled in this area. And so we're looking at the artifacts of a missing people group. Could we also be looking at the high sites, the high places of a prior culture, also now missing? And if there were a cataclysm that had destroyed the installation at Kefkalesi and the other high places, what happened to those people? And this aspect of story was brought home very poignantly on the last day of our tour of the Van province, when we visited a site called Seven Churches. Now today, there's only one church left, and it is in ruins. But once again, you step into that building, and the atmosphere of the place arrests you immediately. You can tell this was a very loved place at the heart of a farming community. And you can still see the art on the walls, somewhat faded. You can see the places where their holy saints had been venerated. You can see the sanctuary where the priests would step up and enter, just like in the Temple of Haldi, and do their ceremonies around the high altar. This beautiful Armenian Orthodox church carries the memory of one of the great tragedies of the First World War period. It makes all the more poignant the images of the priests and bishops and altar boys who served this church before that fateful period when this place of worship had stood for 920 years. The same symbology is there. Crosses carved throughout the building. Triple archways and triptych doors could be seen in every direction as I stood in that amazing place. How is it that this kind of language survives the ages? The symbology of the triptych doorway, the messages of the cross, surviving thousands of years and carrying their meanings with them. What is the meaning of these sites in ancient Anatolia? And what is their true significance in the story of humanity? How far back does their story really go? Whether the ancient Greeks and Romans writing about the great leap forward in material science at the dawn of the Iron Age, or Hebrew scribes locating the reboot of the world's human population in the stories of Adam and Eve, Abraham, or Noah, or Sumerian writers locating the survivors of the Great Flood, or the Bible's identification of the first vineyard planted by Noah after the deluge, or modern paleo-agricultural science identifying the first farm at Karajadar, or the 13th century Norse chieftain Snorri Sturluson telling the sagas of Odin and the advanced Aesir who conquered ancient Europe and Scandinavia, or Urartians or ancient Armenians celebrating their progenitor Hike or their conquering god Haldi, or the curious repetition of symbolic forms all around the world. Many ancient vectors in the world's narrative traditions point to this
mountainous territory as ground zero in the emergence of modern civilization. But will the archaeological evidence support or falsify these ancient narratives? It's to answer these questions that we will return to Van, returning with archaeological and geological expertise to assess the megalithic remains, with ground-penetrating radar to learn exactly what lies buried beneath the hills of Anatolia, with divers to date the megalithic remains on the bed of the largest saltwater lake in Europe, the mysterious Lake Van. The answers to these questions hold profound implications not only for the history of the region, but for the timeline of humanity itself.
Well, I'm talking to you today with a very croaky voice, so you'll have to lean in as I describe what it was like arriving at Kefkalesi. It was an hour of hiking up a mountainside, and as I approached, I began noticing scattered in the ground these basalt blocks that had been thrown enormous distances from their original homes. They'd been engineered, they'd been part of a structure, some of them had corners knocked off them. And then as I went higher up the hill, there are more blocks, and then I arrived at the site where the main installation was, where the structures were, all built of basalt, this time from the ground up. It's quite a large installation with a phenomenal view over Adigevaz, high up, looking down over the kingdom, and a really spectacular location surrounded by mountains. But the overwhelming feeling there was, what on earth happened here? And the scale of the destruction is what makes that site so important to understanding the timeline of this region and the timeline of the human story. These are the questions I'd love to answer. This is why Matt LaCroix is making a film centered here. This is why we're coming back. This is why we're coming back later in the year with archaeologists and geologists. We're going to have ground penetrating radar, soil magnetization technology, because we want to know what is in that hill. Are the remains of Kefkalesi buried in that hill? We want to know the full scope of what the installation was and what happened to it. And if the remains of it are not in that hill, then we really are looking at a tsunami. And a tsunami at that elevation can only mean the Younger Dryas cold period. And if it means that, then the site that we were walking was part of a civilization that existed before the last ice age. And it tells us that so much of what we've been looking at here was built on the foundations of a civilization that we know very little about. And that's what I want to find out about.
So we're going to be returning in September with a film crew, with a geologist, with an archaeologist, and begin probing these really important questions. And if you would like to join us at some point, I know we will be organizing tours to this part of the world because we want to share the experiences we've had in this place and explore these questions together. It is a beautiful part of the world. The Turkish and Kurdish people who live in the Van province are beautiful, warm, and welcoming people. It really is a land of milk and honey. I enjoyed it so much traveling with Matt LaCroix and the whole crew, and I'm looking forward to getting back there very, very soon and sharing with you the things we find.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalog of material along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.